is the chair's prerogative. We're going to change the agenda. We're going to take up 2608 first. And hopefully there'll be some more members here before we get too far along. Patrick, you want to give us a little rundown of where we are in this wonderful bill that the PAC...
You bet, Mr. Chair.
Too thick.
House Bill 2608, we heard on 23rd of March and also on May 11th. That's the bill that requires a person to provide evidence that they're a citizen of the U.S. or are legally present in the United States to receive a driver's license, permit, or ID card. At the last meeting, we had distributed -2 amendments and -3 amendments. You should have those from the last meeting. We also distributed at that time the fiscal impact analysis for both of those bills, or for both of those amendments, I'm sorry. The difference between the -2s and the -3s is the -2 amendments provide for a driver-only card and outline some parameters for that. The -3 amendments are identical in every way, except there is no addition of a driver-only card in the -3 amendments.
Okay, discussion. And Lorna's here, so if you have specific questions, I'm sure she'd be happy to come up and answer them.
Would you like motion?
I'm ready.
You ready for a motion? You and I had a little bit of, I guess I'd preface this, you and I had a little bit of discussion about whether or not the third amendment was absolutely necessary to the to 2608. Would you mind talking about that? The -3.
Yeah. I think most of you in the room here know where I am on this particular piece of legislation. But to be able to get, I feel, the votes I need on the floor to get this bill passed, we're going to need to pass the -3, which do not provide for a driver-only card. So that's where the chair is.
I asked you that question incorrectly. What I meant specifically, I'm not talking about the privilege cards right now. I'm talking about the portion of the amendment of Amendment 3, which I mean, basically is the gut and stuff, and the amendment, the -3 amendment goes to this Social Security verification system, whereas the bill in itself just requires proof of legal presence, which may include the Social Security thing, but you and I had a discussion about identity theft. And I just wondered if you'd had any more thoughts on that.
No. And see, I think indirectly or as ad hoc condition of 2608 as amended, -3s, will satisfy what the definition says that we'll be checking legal status.
Okay.
But that's not the reason for the bill. The reason for the bill, from far as I'm concerned, is to match us as closely as possible with the Real ID Act, which I think we need to do, and I think we need to do it this session.
Right.
There are some people that are thinking, oh, we can wait until 2007 because we got 3 years on the national level to enact that or to conform with that. Well, my conversations with motor vehicles is that it's going to take more than a year to get the systems up and running, and that's why I think it's very important that in this session we pass them. And besides that, it starts the process sooner, and I think most of us are supportive to that. So, further discussion.
Well, the irony is, I think, looking at the votes on the floor, I actually think the -2 amendments are the, if our concern is getting greater support in the full House, I actually think the -2 amendments are the path. Uh-huh. To get that, I don't see any question that there would be more votes for on the -2 amendments on the House floor. I think the far left of the House and the far right of the House would not vote for it, and I think there would be a large number of people in the middle who would, because it not only fully complies with the Federal Real ID Act, but you know, based on just the cumulative nature of all the testimony we received on this, it was, I mean, recognizing it was, we heard testimony from the full spectrum on this issue, and that no one position would satisfy everyone. But I think the -2 amendments, from my perspective, best capture the kind of the center of the spectrum, get us where we need to be in terms of the federal Real ID Act, and actually have a chance of passing this year. So if two of our primary concerns are actually getting an overwhelming vote out of the House that gives it momentum to go over the Senate, and then giving it a realistic chance of passing the Senate and getting the governor's signature, I don't see at all how the -3 amendments get us there at all.
I really respect your point of view on that, and we disagree. That's where it is.
Yeah.
Any further discussion?
Yes, Patrick. Is it appropriate for me to mention that we've been recommended that the bill will need to go to the Budget Committee? The fiscal impact on that. I think I mentioned it at the last meeting.
Yes, you did.
And we have permission from the Speaker's office to do so, given the fiscal analysis that we received for both the -2 and the -3 amendments are far exceed the threshold for
also the motion's going to need to be.
That would be the second motion. The motion, once an amendment, if an amendment is adopted, once an amendment is adopted, the second motion, I think it would be appropriate.
If it goes to House budget.
Yeah.
Yes, Chair. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that item. Any further questions, comments before I take a motion? Representative Thatcher, I'm ready for a motion.
I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 2608.
Representative Thatcher moves the -3 amendments to 2608. Discussion. Yes,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I am going to vote no against this because I don't see it, I mean, for most of the same reasons that Representative Hunt has outlined. And I just am not sure that I see this as a solution to a problem at this point. I think it could be something that could drive a problem a little deeper underground as opposed to solving one. So I'm going to be a no.
Any further discussion? With a no vote, Pat, Mike, we'll need the. We'll do a roll call.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
No.
Representative Boone?
No.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, we're ready for a motion to go to. House budget. Representative Thatcher. Oh, Representative Broom.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2608 as amended to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Broom moves 2608 as amended to the House Budget Committee. Discussion. Michael.
Representative Broom?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
No.
Representative Boone?
No.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you very much. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 373. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 373A, or Senate Bill, I'm sorry, 373A, allows certain employees to provide educational services and certain employees of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to request that the Department of Transportation use their address of their employer rather than their personal residence address on records maintained by the department. It also clarifies statute involving the use of a person's address on department records. This bill was moved through the Senate on a 26-1 vote. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. And we just received this morning, about 2 hours ago, the -A5 amendments. Those are conflict amendments, similar to the ones that we that we dealt with on the previous bill that had a conflict, Senate Bill 74. This bill, the conflict with this bill is with a House bill that was passed. You'll see its number referenced, 2261. That bill came out of the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee. It is a bill that revises and corrects grammar and punctuation errors throughout Oregon statute, kind of a revising bill. It's 371 pages long, so it covered a lot of statute, was basically just revising statute. What these amendments do then is clarify that if both bills are signed by the governor, it just combines the language of both those bills, and these amendments clarify that.
Thanks, Patrick. Tricia Smith and John Stupenvall.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith, and I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents nearly 20,000 educational professionals working in a wide variety of educational settings, from Oregon's Head Start agencies, K-12 schools, ESDs, community colleges, park and recreation agencies, and public libraries. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 373A, which affects a very unique and small segment of our membership. For many years, the legislature has recognized that certain public employees face personal risks as a result of their jobs and have attempted to provide them some anonymity in shielding them from the requirement to disclose their residence address on DMV records. ORS 802-250, which Senate Bill 373 amends, permits public employees such as corrections officers, police officers, employees of the Department of Human Resources that are working directly with clients, and certain other employees to use their employer's address as their address of record on their motor vehicle records and their driver records. These employees must provide DMV with written documentation from their employer that they do indeed work in these situations. Senate Bill 373 adds certain educational employees and certain employees of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to the list of employees allowed this protection in ORS 802-250. The legislation is specific to only those employees who work in environments with an elevated risk to their personal safety. I'm going to address the portions of the bill that affect educational employees. Mr. Stubenvall will tell you about the OLCC employees that are affected. Most of our members work in K-12 school districts in typical school settings. Senate Bill 373A would not affect these education professionals. But a small segment of educators in Oregon work in very non-traditional settings where their personal safety can be at risk. These educators teach or provide other educational services to children and adults who are incarcerated or otherwise committed to state facilities, or they provide special education services in the homes of clients. They work for education service districts and for community colleges throughout the state that have contracted with state agencies to provide these educational services to the persons that they have in their charge. When this bill was heard in the Senate, two of these employees, Kathleen Adamson and Kathy Bonagoski, who both work for Willamette Education Service District, came and testified to their situations and why this bill is important to them. As employees of Willamette ESD, Ms. Adamson works in the Oregon State Hospital Forensics Unit, teaching young adults. And Ms. Bonagoski provides special education services to children in their homes. Unfortunately, it is very difficult for Ms. Adams and Ms. Bonagoski to come to the Capitol and testify before a committee because they have to take the day off work. And in those situations, taking a day off is a difficult thing to do. It's hard to get a substitute. They don't get paid. And so they asked me to provide you with their testimony that they gave to the Senate when this bill was heard there. And it is attached to my testimony, and you can read for yourself from their firsthand experience why this bill is important. Employees like Ms. Adamson, who provide educational services to children and adults in state-operated facilities, including those working in adult correctional, Oregon Youth Authority facilities such as McLaren and Hillcrest, and, as I said, the Oregon State Hospital Forensics Unit. Other employees, like Ms. Bonagoski, provide these special education services through the state and federal early intervention programs to children in their homes when they are at preschool age. While the jobs are different from employees of the Department of Human Resources or the Oregon Corrections Department, the settings and the clients with whom these education professionals work are not at all different, nor is the risk to their personal safety. The statute's been modified over the years as the legislature became aware of other classes of employees that face this kind of situation. Senate Bill 373 was drafted very narrowly to protect only this small group of employees. Educators working in school settings would not, this bill would not apply to them. This bill would apply to no educator that is working in anything other than the settings that I described to you. These are folks who have, as a part of the nature of their work, a higher risk, an elevated risk to their personal safety. I've contacted the Willamette Education Service District, the Department of Education, the Department of Human Resources, and the Oregon Youth Authority about the bill. All of these agencies are supportive of it. The Motor Vehicles Division has no concern about the bill either. I'd hope that you would pass the bill, put it on your consent calendar, and shoot it out the door, because this is one that I think everybody likes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. I'm John Steubenvall, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'll be very brief. OLCC likes this bill because, quite simply, this is a good way that we can give our public employees an additional tool to protect their safety and that of their families. This bill has been very narrowly crafted regarding OLCC in particular, as it applies to only three types of OLCC employees: liquor regulatory inspectors, license investigators, and regulatory managers. And these are our staff, OLCC staff, who day in and day out work directly with liquor license holders or the patrons of liquor license holders. And that puts these our folks at some risk to their personal safety. And it's the way the bill is crafted, it would apply to only 63 OLCC staff members. Now, this isn't a big number. 63 clearly is not a big number of state employees, but it's an important provision for those staffers to whom it applies, and they're very anxious to have this bill apply to them. And I, with that, we encourage you to move this bill along. Be happy to respond to questions.
Questions? Yes, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, in the AIM Gross version on page 3, line 6, it refers to an employee of OLCC who is a regulatory manager. Do we know exactly what that means? How inclusive is that? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, yes, these are working managers. We have, I believe the number is 6 to whom this would apply, and these are folks who run our field offices. So these are folks who run an office in Bend, Pendleton, Salem, Eugene, Medford, these are not desk job jockey type staffers. These are folks who are out in the field, who interact directly with liquor license holders and applicants, who work the bar and restaurants day in and day out.
Okay, thank you.
So, further questions?
Yes.
And, Mr. Chair, one other point. We just received the -A5 amendment, and I noticed that the amendment begins on page 3 of the AIM Gross bill and then goes on to, I think, essentially act as a gut and stuff of the bill, but the existing AIM Gross bill has the language adding educational employees on page 2, and I'm not sure how the amendment and the bill will work together, so I'm sure the smart folks at Legislative Council have this all figured out, and I don't need to be concerned about it, but I'll just say that on the record.
I would call to your attention on the A5-A5 amendment, page 1, line 1, it says to insert after line 23. So it's not a gut and stuff. It's adding that language.
Right, which would then repeat the new language on page 2, I assume maybe in another part of the statute, or
right.
I'm not sure why we would repeat it in two separate sections.
That's the wonderful world of LC, but...
Yes, yeah. And so as I said, I'm sure that it's exactly perfect, mm-hmm. and I'll just register my confusion.
Further questions? I have one more. John gave us an idea of the number. Do you have a ballpark number for us of the number of people that this would cover?
Chair Gilman, we tried to come up with one for DMV because they are concerned about opening the statute to hordes of people. And we were not successful in coming up with an exact number. We have very few employees who will be covered, probably under 200, but we don't represent all education employees. So but the language is, as I said, is crafted so narrowly that they have to be working in these settings for this to apply to them.
Thank you. Okay, anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 373? Close the public hearing and open a work session on 373. Representative Hunt.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 373A.
It's an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 373.
Thank you. Representative Hunt moves the dash A5 amendments to 373. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Now, Representative Hunt,
I'm so enthusiastic about this bill. I would move Senate Bill 373A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Cool. Representative Hunt moves Senate Bill 373 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Mike?
Aye.
President
Thatcher?
Aye.
President
Byer?
Aye.
President Boone?
Aye.
President
Burley?
Aye.
President
Burley? Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move we put this on the consent calendar.
Thank you. Representative Byer moves to place 373 on the consent calendar. Any opposition? There was one negative vote, but I suspect I know who that was on the Senate side.
I can confirm that for you. My senator, you think?
It was
Senator Atkinson.
Oh! Gotcha. Okay. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 487. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 487 extends the period of validity of driver's licenses, vehicle registrations, and registration plates for members of the Oregon National Guard and military reservists who are serving on active duty outside of the United States to 90 days following the termination of that active duty status. 28-0 in the Senate. It has the revenue impact statement for the measure is attached. That was considered on the Senate side, and there was no fiscal impact to the measure.
Thank you. Mike, welcome. First time for this committee this time.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's true. I've spent half my life in this room, however, on another committee with a couple of your distinguished colleagues on the panel. I'm sure it's been worthwhile and certainly been fun, but this is the first time before this distinguished committee, and I appreciate the opportunity. For the record, I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and this bill was not introduced at our request. However, it did come up, I think, through some constituents' concerns, particularly with the number of deployments that we've had. And as you can tell with the bill, it deals with three primary issues related to the Department of Motor Vehicles, the driver's license, registration of a vehicle, and the plates. What we found is that based on the length of some of the deployments that we've experienced, particularly with soldiers who are single, without family or spouse back to take care of their certain affairs, they return home and suddenly find that they've let their license lapse or their registration or their vehicle license, one of those three problems. And certainly no fault of their own, the deployments have lasted considerably longer than what we've traditionally experienced. Right now our deployments are running on an average of 18 months. Right now we've deployed over almost 4,000 Oregon Guardsmen since the beginning of the War on Terror, which I think the official start date is September 11, 2001. So we've had a good number of Oregon Guardsmen, Oregon citizens, who have been called to active duty. And again, the length of deployment has been significantly longer than previous deployments. So it has become a minor issue. It's not epidemic throughout the force, but it's certainly an issue that I'm pleased, and we are pleased, that Senator Courtney and Speaker Menas chose to take on as an item that could be fixed and make life just a little simpler for their soldiers upon their return. And with that, I would say we support the legislation, and I would encourage you to pass it along and see if we can't get it into statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
Yes, sir, I do.
In line 15 and 23, it talks about deployment outside the United States. For all of your folks who often start off and sometimes finish up their deployments, and maybe their entire deployment may be within the United States but outside of Oregon, are those folks in a position where they have access and can renew their licenses is really the only problem for folks who are deployed outside the United States, or should we look at broadening that definition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, the folks that are deployed outside the continental United States have more difficulty getting their mail and other issues, where inside the United States you have particularly the Air National Guard, and they're the best example. We had a unit out of Astoria or Camp Withica or Camp Rialia who was deployed for 14 months right after 9/11, and they were scattered from Arizona to it was a radar unit, and they were folks in Arizona, Wyoming, Washington, and California. So they were divided up and split out to four different locations. I guess the good news is were in the continental United States. Secondly, they had all of the access to internet, telephones, and those sort of things that we have available to us on a daily basis. The real issue becomes outside the United States, where you don't have those accoutrements, if you will, or those technological advantages, and it becomes more difficult even for mail. I mean, mail sometimes takes 6 weeks to get into Iraq or Afghanistan. So it's just not feasible, particularly in a war zone where you have other concerns, particularly in the situation we see in Iraq today. It's not feasible for them to do the daily mundane things that all of us love to do when we get home at night, but these folks don't have that opportunity. In a perfect world, yeah, it'd be great if they were even inside the United States, but that isn't the biggest part of the problem. I would recommend, instead of going through amendments and having to go through all that we get this moved out, and then we take a real hard look and poll our people and see if there was an issue. If there is, we can come back next session and maybe get it added.
Mike, further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here before you today.
Happy to have you. Robin?
She likes it. That's awesome. I wanted a nod of the head. Oh, there we go. That's what I wanted.
Let the record show that Robin Freeman nodded her head.
That's Robin the Freeman, the chair for the record.
Whoops. Is there anyone else to testify on Bill 487? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing and open work session on Senate Bill 487.
Mr. Chair, I move that we report Senate Bill 487 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Burley moves 487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Excuse me, my joke.
Yes, Representative.
I just wanted to say that I won't do it. Colonel Caldwell, but it would be nice to just have this be suspended until they get back so that they don't have to worry about even meeting the 90-day in case it happens halfway through the tour and they're still kind of out of luck. So just to make 2 cents.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Yeah, maybe we should just start by the issue only becomes 90 days after they return.
Okay, Mike, I think we're ready.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Berlin?
Aye.
Representative Berlin?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Chair Gillman?
Aye. Motion carries. Motion for the consent calendar. Representative Thatcher moves we place 487 on the consent calendar. Discussion? Objection? Motion carries. Very good. Open a hearing on Senate Bill 493. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 493A allows a person who's lawfully using a bicycle lane to proceed through a red light at the top of a key intersection after stopping at the light. That creates the offense of an improper stop at a light at a key intersection, punishable by a maximum fine of $360. The bill, of course, describes the key intersection, and I'm sure we'll have somebody who can explain that in further depth coming before the committee.
Scott? Where's Scott? There he is.
Thank you, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bricker. I work with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Alignment Pedestrian Coalition, so walkers and bikers. Senate Bill 493 is not our bill, so I don't have all the information on it. But since it was a bicycle-related bill, I thought I should come up here and at least give my input on how we feel about the bill and where we were when it was on the Senate side. Just for a little background, my understanding of what this would do would allow bicyclists at the top of a T-intersection. So when you have a T-intersection where there's a stoplight at this T, but there's no turning movement at the top of the T, it would allow bicyclists to stop and then go through the red light at the top of the T-intersection unless there was a driveway or some other access at that point. Generally, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance is neutral on this bill. We have some concerns and we have some other aspects that we think is reasonable. Our major concern about this bill is that we are generally uncomfortable with having bicycles going through red lights and other cases where other vehicles aren't supposed to do the same thing. So cars can turn right on red. Bicyclists can also turn red on red. We're uncomfortable generally with having bicyclists going through red lights in all their circumstances when all their vehicles are supposed to do so. And actually last session there was a bill about rolling through stop signs. There's a piece of that of the draft legislation that would have also allowed bicyclists to stop and treat stoplights as red lights, and we told folks that we couldn't support that. Generally, we feel like this is a safe provision. I have to do this a couple of times on my commute into downtown Portland, and I stop at those red lights, and I can understand where this would be a fairly safe provision unless perhaps another bicyclist was turning on the oncoming bike lane or another situation where, say, a truck might be coming in and need a wide turning area, which often the bike lane can be used for. So generally, we're neutral on this bill. And again, this was not our bill, but I thought I would just and also answer questions if you had any clarification issues you wanted. That concludes my testimony. Thanks.
Thank you. If I understand this correctly, I mean, we're talking about making a right-hand turn at a T-intersection.
We're talking about going straight at the top of a T-intersection. So, yeah, Yeah, it allows bicyclists to stop at a red light.
If a bicyclist is traveling, I think if you're at the T looking at the perpendicular road, it's in a bicycle lane traveling from right to left at the top of the T. That's a portion that's not intersected by the
by the perpendicular road. So if the roads are like this, it's at the top of that traveling right to left.
So
now wait a minute, though. If you say a bicycle lane, I don't think it just limits it to a bicycle lane, does it?
I'm not sure.
Line 13.
Yeah. Line 13. Oh, okay. You have to be in the bicycle lane.
Oh, okay. Well, that changes a little bit.
Yeah. So basically,
you have to stop first, and then you can go through the red light.
And it's only in cases where it's not intersected by the road, which means a person traveling on a bicycle lane from left to right, then it's intersected by the part of the intersection. So they would have, that it would not apply there because at the red light, then the traffic would be moving through there. Yeah. That's my understanding of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe we need the whiteboard.
I'd be happy to draw it on the whiteboard if you want me to with a pen. Again, I think.
Read that way.
Well, follow up question.
Yeah.
Also, in line 17 and 23, I noticed that if a pedestrian's in the crosswalk that intersects the bicycle lane, they have to wait. We're not doing a lane plus adjacent here if it's a bicycle.
Well. Yeah.
Making a point.
Although I do believe that.
Any additional questions?
I'll leave that alone.
Mr. Chair, who brought the bill forward? Whose bill is it?
Daniel Heffernan.
The bill was introduced by the Committee on Judiciary. The contact person for the bill was the staffer for Senator Burdick. And never received a call back from Senator Burdick's office on the bill after giving them a call notifying them of the hearing.
Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 493? Representative Dingfelter.
Welcome.
Sorry, I'm here for Senate Bill 938, which is what I
the next.
No, you don't want to talk about this one.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the hearing on 493, and we're not going to work it right now. I think we need to have a discussion. Okay, open the public here. Oh, now, which one are you here for? Is it 938?
938. Sorry, I ran out of my command.
938. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 938. And Patrick, it's a rundown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 938 provides exception for bicycles for the offense of passing on the right, modifies prohibited bicycle speed for purposes of offense of unsafe operation of a bicycle on a sidewalk, and provides exemption for offensive failure to use a bicycle path or lane. This bill has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. The vote on the Senate side was 19-5. I believe there's some testimony in your packets from Kat Iverson of Portland, and also some -A2 amendments, which I believe I can speak to if it's the chair's desire.
Yes, I'd appreciate covering the amendments too before the representative gets, because she might want to put her oil in the water about that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the amendments which are drafted amend on page 2, lines 8 and 9. What they do is they return that portion of the bill to the existing language. The bill allowed for passing at speeds greater than walking speed as long as they were still safe, and the amendments return that to the original language, which limits the speed to walking to pedestrian speed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Now, Representative, I'm ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I ran out of my water committee in the middle of a very interesting discussion, but I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill today, Senate Bill 938. My name's Jackie Dingfelder. I'm State Representative for House District 45 in Northeast Portland. And for some of you who know me, I'm an avid cyclist. We started the Biker Caucus here in the Capitol. We're still looking for somebody of the other party to join our caucus, so I will throw that out as an invitation, because we prefer to have a balanced Biker Caucus. But as a cyclist who is very supportive of safe cycling, I wanted to come in and testify in support of Senate Bill 938. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it does and why I think it's a good bill. A 938 is aimed at protecting safe and law-abiding cyclists, which are the majority of cyclists, while ensuring that errant and unsafe cyclists are held accountable. And just as there's good drivers and bad drivers, I believe it's the same with cyclists. And I think part of it is that we need to make sure we have good education for both motorists and cyclists. So fair laws are only one part of increasing safe cycling, and I support, along with a lot of the bicycle community, education, as I mentioned, of both cyclists and motorists, and enforcement of laws governing cyclists. And I am very supportive of making sure that we have good laws and then obviously enforce the laws for both cyclists and motorists. Safe and law-abiding cyclists, why is it important to have good laws for bicycling? I am very supportive of bicycling as a means for healthy, efficient ways of travel, reduces traffic. And as I tell people, when I'm on my bike and not in my car, there's more room on the road for you who are, or for those who might be in their car. But I think it's important that we provide safety for cyclists that choose to cycle. Bicyclists integrate with traffic, and we need cyclists to maintain predictable behavior, and that's part of what this bill would do, is make sure that what cyclists' activities are legal and safe. And we aim to minimize confrontations, sometimes due to lack of bicycle lanes and side paths, and the fact that there are road hazards and inadequate facilities. Sometimes bicyclists are required to ride on the sidewalk and in suboptimal conditions. And as much as I would say I don't like to ride on sidewalks, sometimes it happens. There's construction in the road, something that's blocking the bike lane, and you have to go around and cycle on the sidewalk. So Senate Bill 938 provides safety and protection for safe and novice cyclists. We want to make sure that everybody understands what's legal and what isn't, and to make it as safe as possible for cyclists who are law-abiding. So 938 changes three important provisions of Oregon law that reflect safe and normal cycling practices. This bill provides cyclists with fair protection under the law in event of crashes. Because what happens, obviously, if there's a crash and there'll be a look to see who is at fault and who was abiding by the law and who not. And you're going to see some pictures that show examples, if you don't already have that, that I think is really the best way to demonstrate what this law does, because it's difficult to explain in words. But when you see the pictures, I think it'll illuminate for you why this is an important bill. This bill impacts commuters and improves safety for young children bicycling for fun. And I know we've talked a lot in this body about obesity, and I did stand up on the floor along with my colleague, Representative Burley, and support the Safe Routes to Schools bill, because we believe that cycling is one way we can fight childhood obesity if it's safe for children to bike to school, as it was in many of our days. So the first element in the bill is looking at passing on the right. And Senate Bill 938 would allow cyclists to pass on the right under safe and reasonable conditions. This, of course, keeping cyclists separated from auto traffic. And right now, cyclists are not permitted on many roadways to pass stop traffic on wide shoulders. Rather, are required to merge into stop traffic. And we have somebody here who's an attorney who often represents cyclists that's going to provide more details on that. The second part would remove unnecessary restrictions on speed on sidewalks and crosswalks. And this would allow a cyclist to ride at a reasonable speed rather than at 3 miles per hour, which is currently required on the sidewalk and in crosswalks. 3 miles per hour on a bike, you're practically falling over, because that's the speed that was set for pedestrians, and it doesn't necessarily work for cyclists. So that is the second part of the bill. And third, we're looking at clarifying laws regarding bicycle lanes and paths. 938 would allow cyclists to leave bicycle lanes or paths for certain things. For instance, if I'm making a left turn and this happens to me all the time, and I really, you don't want to break the law, but what happens is, not saying that I ever do, but you're in a bike lane on the right hand side, and I can tell you, because I bike on Airport Way quite often, where there is a bike lane, and then I need to make a left turn. So in order to make a left turn, I would have to leave the bike lane, enter the left turn lane, because there's a turn signal there. Well, legally, you can't do that. So what I do is I have to, because you can't leave the bike lane the way our current statutes read. So you have to cross at the light, then I would cross over. And it's actually more dangerous that way because you're off on the side. A lot of times cars can't see you. And so that's an example of where a biker needs to leave the bike lane in order to make a left turn, or if there's debris in the roadway, which unfortunately I would say I wish we had more money in ODOT's budget to sweep bike lanes, because oftentimes there's a lot of debris, and in order to get around that debris, you have to leave the bike lane. Or people do park, although it's illegal. There's oftentimes where a car's parked in a bike lane, and I have to, or a cyclist would have to go around it. Well, legally, you're not supposed to leave the bike lane. So what we're trying to do is clarify that it would be legal in certain instances, and so it wouldn't force cyclists to unfortunately have to break the law in order to have a safe cycling route. So there are people here who are going to talk in more details. I just wanted to come in as somebody who does practice what I preach. I cycle for fitness and also for alternative transportation. My husband is an avid cyclist and serves on the City of Portland's Bicycle Advisory Committee, and they've been working on these recommendations as well and support this bill. So I would just like to urge your support for this bill. We had a very robust discussion in the Senate, and have worked out many issues, and it's the first time I've seen the amendment, so I can't comment on at this point, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I again appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Yeah. Since you said there was a robust discussion in the Senate, I'm just wondering what I noticed there were several that voted against it. Did they give any reasons for it, or were they not part of that discussion?
You know, I wasn't there for the final vote because it was in the public hearing, and that was during the work session, and I'm sure that some of the folks who were there could speak to that. But I think it was more clarifying. Again, if you're not a cyclist, it's hard to envision what the issues are until they're explained and, you know, you walk through. And so there was just a good discussion. I thought that people asked some very good questions, and I'm not recalling exactly what the issues were, why there were no votes, but I know there's people here who can answer that question.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You,
appreciate
Representative,
taking the time.
Scott, is it Catherine and Ray?
Okay, if we do a little group thing here.
I'll take all of you, yes.
You have the testimony. I'm going to give it to somebody. Okay.
You're going to start, Scott.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter to me.
Thank you, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. I'm just going to do a brief introduction on Senate Bill 938 and then pass it over to our guest here, who's Catherine Charlo, who is the Executive Director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. She's my boss. And Ray Thomas, who is also a member of the BTA's Legislative Committee, but also a legal expert on bicycle issues. Just as a real quick background, you've heard what Senate Bill 938 does generally, and there will be more explanation here. We did have a positive response in the Senate with a 19-5 passage. It was actually a unanimous passage through the committee and a 19-5 on the floor, and both Republicans and Democrats supported the bill from a variety of types of constituencies. One of the things I did hear is trying to get to Representative Thatcher's questions. There was one statement on the floor that had concern about the funding of bicycle issues, and this bill doesn't really deal with that. I think it was more of a philosophical issue that it had been actually the text of this bill, so we hope that we can get to the text of this bill today. And the changes, there were minor changes due to our original bill, but we feel really comfortable with them. This is our bill. We requested this bill as opposed to the last one I testified on. And so we're excited and hope that it moves today. Finally, I know I had another point, but I think I will let it go from there. Oh, actually, my last point was that the Dash 2A amendments, we will address those today. We've met with everyone on the committee at least once, and we've met with Chair Gilman and Vice Chair Burley, and we feel comfortable with the Dash 2A amendments. There are three distinct provisions of this bill, all important, and if we have to move two of them forward and kind of address the other one later or figure out how to deal with that in the following session, we're okay with that. Then I'll pass it off. Thank you very much.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, thanks very much for the opportunity to testify in front of you today. I, as Scott said, am Catherine Charlo. I'm the executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. As you probably know, we're a statewide nonprofit organization that works to promote bicycling and improve bicycling conditions in Oregon. And a big part of why we do the work we do is about giving people options and creating vital communities. And a really important piece of that for us is making sure that the options we're giving people are safe and legal. It's not in our interest in any way to promote a type of bicycling that isn't safe and isn't legal, partly because that just makes our job harder. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the bill in front of you today and about how we got to the issues that it includes. Taking a step back, I liked what Representative Dingfelder said when she kind of drew some distinctions about bicyclists. The BTA has worked for years to really make conditions better for folks who are safe and law-abiding cyclists. And in fact, we had the passing on the right provision in front of this body in 2001, and the committee at that time was very interested and supportive of the provision. It was connected with something else that the committee didn't support, so that didn't move forward at that time. But it's something we've seen over the years really play out in a way that causes some consternation for cyclists and for motorists. What we see with passing on the right is places where it's quite logical and practical for a cyclist to move forward, and in fact makes more sense for all of the users of the road, but puts the cyclist in a position where if they are proceeding carefully and legally, and a motorist, for example, is talking on a cell phone and eating a hamburger and chewing gum and looking over their shoulder and turns into them, that cyclist is still considered at fault. And we've seen that happen and really are hoping to address that to make conditions better and more logical for everyone on the road. Similarly, with the leaving the bike lane provision, I thought Representative Dingfelder did a wonderful job explaining why, if there's a huge pile of dirt in front of you, you would want to be able to legally leave the bike lane and not find yourself at fault in the event of a crash where someone else was negligent. And finally, although, as Scott mentioned, we are comfortable with the Dash 2 amendments and moving forward with those amendments, one of the reasons we had put the quote crosswalk provision in is really about kids who ride on sidewalks. And one of the things that does is protect a child who is crossing, say, a driveway, and you could have someone turn quickly and negligently into a driveway and hit a child in that driveway. And again, it would be considered the child's fault if it couldn't be shown that they were moving slowly enough to be below the threshold. So I just wanted to put that rationale out there, although, as I say, we're comfortable moving forward with the amendments. Finally, I guess I want to say, in terms of the other kind of cyclists out there, there's a big body of cyclists that just isn't educated about the laws, and that is a big part of what the BTA does. We have a lot of programs. We have a bike safety program. We have a Safe Routes to School program, which Representative Burley knows quite a bit about, and you all have supported as well. That's a big part of our mission. The piece that we want to be really careful about, and we have been very careful about in putting this bill together, is not trying to give legal traction to people who ride illegally or unsafely. We've been quite mindful and careful about that. Our legislative committee is made up of folks from a pretty broad cross-section of the private sector, and they, over the years, have worked with us to kind of identify these issues, put them in the context of this bill, and bring the bill forward to you. So with that, I am going to close. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify on the bill and invite any questions and turn the testimony over to Ray Thomas, who is a member of our legislative committee.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we'll hold questions until we finish the panel, and then we'll take care of all of them.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me today. I have introduced myself to you before. People in the bike community think of me as Oregon's bike law geek. This is my book, Pedal Power. It's in its fourth edition right now. And what I have done with within the GTA Legislative Committee is listen to stories about what happens to people where they are riding safely, but for one reason or another, after there's an accident, the law gets used against them in ways that people didn't really think about. And what we've done is come up with three ways we're thinking that we'd ask you to help us improve the law. And I know with the amendment, I think I'm hearing the message, well, on the crosswalk law, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board. But let me give you a kind of a, I guess, a heartfelt reason why it is that we've done this. And that is, as Catherine Charlo told you, that while we all somewhat have mixed feelings about bicycles on sidewalks, the law requires that a bicycle rider on a sidewalk, if they're going to pass a pedestrian, give an audible signal and yield to a pedestrian. In my own case, my daughter can ride to the MAX station if she stays on the sidewalk, and I feel pretty comfortable with that because there's a way for with sidewalks and crosswalks for her not to go into the busy streets near my house, which is Barnes, there in front of St. Vincent's Hospital up in Portland near 217. That's a real busy street, and I just don't really feel comfortable having a 12-year-old kid out there even riding with the traffic. But on the sidewalk, I feel okay about it. The problem is that coming down the hill in front of St. Vincent's Hospital, even when she's got the walk signal, sometimes people aren't paying attention, and it's hard to say to her, well, you can't go more than 3 miles an hour, because if you just kind of roll on a bike, you're generally going 4 or 5. And the other thing about this crosswalk law is that almost nobody knows about it. So it's kind of a trap for the bicyclists. And I teach it all the time to them, but I understand that there's some discomfort on the committee. And what we want to do, we're there to improve the situation in the law. So if two of these are acceptable to you and you don't feel comfortable with that one, then that's fine with us. The other two I don't think I need to spend too much time with. I'm the author of this thing, and Scott Bricker over here is one of the models in the pictures, but they pretty well show you. On the first page here, you can see these folks, they're in a line of stop traffic, and if they're going to be not able to pass to the right, what they get stuck with is in this line of cars, and they're kind of clogging up the intersection. If they can go off to the right, which is the lower two pictures, you can see how we really kind of fill the road and make it more efficient. A lot of folks who are rural folks really like this because what it does is it gets the bike riders off the center of the road where there's the high-speed rural traffic and over to the shoulder. If you got enough shoulder, let the bike riders be over there. The second page is the pedestrian crosswalk, which I've already talked about. The third page, I think you probably have heard enough about this and maybe even seen it yourselves, but you take it, I mean, you just think about these bike lanes. If somebody drops some gravel or there's trash on a bike lane, the problem is, while the legislature didn't really say you shouldn't leave a bike lane under any circumstances, unfortunately the law just says if there's a bike lane you have to use it, and there's no exceptions to it. So you're kind of, as a bike rider, kidnapped and held prisoner by the bike lane. But with this law, what it does is it allows you, if there's some, we used a couple of pretty good examples where you want to turn left and go across a few lanes, or here there's some vehicles that are situations up in Portland you see a lot where somebody just for some reason parks on the bike lane, or maybe they're unloading some equipment or something. What you want to be able to do is to get out of that bike lane and then go around. In summary, what I would suggest to you in trying to figure out how could this possibly come before you in such a way that it would not make something legal that's presently unsafe and illegal, what we tried to do is to draft it so that the goofy things that you see bike riders doing are still illegal. It doesn't make any of those things legal. And believe me, when you think about the goofy things that bike riders do and how irritated you are about them, for me, as a lawyer who represents bike riders in front of Portland juries, every time I see a bike messenger blow through a red light, I go, oh, I wish you hadn't have done that, because that's what everybody remembers. And we get telephone calls in the legislative committee and at the PTA from these angry motorists saying, well, why don't you make the bike riders follow the law? And one of the things that I like to do is to teach people by saying, you know, the law really does apply to you as bike riders, and the law makes sense. And if you look at the law, you'll see that people thought about these rules to make it so that you have to follow them just like the cars. And what I would like to do, if we're successful here, is to say, and you know, we went to the legislature. We've really got to stay in the bike lane, except under these circumstances. And then we tell them the exceptions. When we teach them a system that makes sense toward them, it's a whole lot easier to teach it to them and make them obey it than it is when everything's kind of goofy and it kind of is, well, and this is what I hear all the time and it really kind of makes me mad, well, the laws really don't apply to us. I mean, if you think about the laws applying to us bike riders, they don't make much sense. And what I want to say back is, well, the law applies to all of us. Your vehicle's due and you have to follow the law. So if you help us, what we want to do is we want to be able to publicize your good efforts and try to get the bike riders to, they got their rights, but they also have their legal responsibilities. So thanks for your hard work.
Thank you, Ray. Questions now with the panel. Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the Dash-A2 amendments, my memory from when we met was that currently there are not speed restrictions on, we talked about inline skaters, skateboards,
rollerblades, running pedestrians.
Kind of thing. So am I accurate that the current, in terms of the current statute, the only speed restrictions are on bicycles?
That's right. And the other thing is, if you look at the statute that presently exists, you'll see that there already is a provision in it that says that a bicyclist may not leave a place of safety and dart out in front of vehicles. I mean, they're specifically prohibited from doing that. So every time you see somebody doing that, it is specifically in violation of the laws that already exist. And this law amend the, well, 938 would not change the illegality of that. It wouldn't make legal what was before illegal in that regard. It just makes it so that of all those classes of vehicles, bike riders are not stuck with the lowest speed limit, which is really the kind of the way it is right now.
So could I ask, where did the Dash-2 amendments come from?
Me. And I was pretty firm about it. As far as I'm concerned, when that bike is in a sidewalk, pedestrians have the right of way, and I'm sure that, I hope that's what the law is, and I don't care if it is or not, that's the law I think it should be. And I don't want those bicycles exceeding the speed of those pedestrians. I personally, I'm a biker, I thoroughly enjoy riding my bike, and I'm getting old enough now that I always get off my bike and walk across the crosswalk at the intersection. It just, you know, I live in an area where there's still not ramps at every one too, so you have to jump off the curb. But I can't do that. I can get off the curb, but I can't get back on. So anyway, it's my thought, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I felt about it. Where they came from. Questions?
Yes. First, I want to say this is just very helpful in illustrating what the bill is all about, and I really appreciate that. But as I was sitting here, I was thinking about being one of these drivers in one of these vans up here, and if I decided to turn right and you were there, I might hit you if you're kind of coming up at the right time, and that concerns me. Though I think in general it would make sense to be able to get you moved over to the right.
I can help you with that in terms of that intersection, because I was the photographer and I was watching the drivers. And for example, that's at I think Northeast 15th and not in Portland. And what generally happens is when you're approaching an intersection like that, where it's basically four corners and people are coming in from two different directions or four different directions, what you'll see is that drivers who are going to be turning right, well, you know, they're required by law to use a turn signal for one thing. So generally, if they're following the law, the drivers are going to have their turn signal on. And, of course, for us bike riders, that's what we look for, is that if there's a right-turning motorist, we don't want to get on the right side of that person. And it's considered an unsafe maneuver to go on the right side of somebody turning right. The other thing is, just as with body language, that kind of tells us what we're doing in the corridors of this building. So on the roadway, what will happen will be when somebody's making a right turn, generally in addition to their turn signal, they'll drift off to the side. You'll see that line of cars in the photograph. That wasn't staged. Those folks all happened to be turning or going straight. None of them were turning right. Mm-hmm. So what we are in the kind of the business of doing is we want to be safe by riding with the traffic and not being in a situation where we're kind of stuck up in there with the cars in that line of cars. We want to be able to be off to the side.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? No, I guess not. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 938? Close the public hearing on 938 and open the work session.
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
Based on the situation, I totally understand the concern with protecting pedestrians. If we've got a situation now where mopeds and skateboards and inline skates can exceed the speed of pedestrians, does it seem inconsistent to have basically pedestrians and bikes at one speed and then all these other folks at another speed? I mean, even joggers can exceed the...
Oh, sure. Yeah. I know that. And one of the other things, a feeling I have, is that and this Bike Alliance, as far as I'm concerned, do an excellent job, and but there are bad actors out there. There's some people that don't know the rules, and I guess it comes back to an attitude. Okay, is a bike a pedestrian or is it a vehicle? And in my mind, it's more a vehicle than it is a they are pedestrians. That's just my attitude. You can run over me on this one. It's not a critical thing.
I
don't know how the rest of the committee feels.
Well, actually, I thought it was kind of interesting because I did bring up concerns about being in the crosswalk. My mother always taught me to get off the bike and walk my bike across. And I've been a motorist where I've seen a bike, I wasn't expecting it. It felt like they probably weren't going all that fast, but I wasn't expecting it as a driver to have them zoom. I'm about ready to turn. And they're coming out of nowhere is what it felt like to me. And,
Yes.
Yeah, we had, I think, good long discussion, or my office had a good long discussion with the Bike Alliance as well. And I applaud them for what they're trying to do here is to increase bike safety. But as I conveyed to them, I spent over a decade working in downtown Portland. And that's what makes it, I'm at this point likely to do a yes courtesy vote, but then, retain my ability to vote on the House floor based on some information that may come between now and then. But the thing that makes this only a courtesy vote as opposed to a yeah, let's do this vote, it's simply that. The countless, and I don't want to exaggerate, but the countless bad examples of bad bikers that I experienced while working in downtown Portland. And so if we can enforce those folks, then a good bill like this could help the rest of the law-abiding folks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Booth.
We'll weigh in for you, too. I live on the state highway, and I used to ride my bike on it, but I don't anymore, but... just for safety reasons, but I don't see that kind of thing out there because that would probably, they'd only do it once. Long truck drifts a little bit, that'd be it. No. The bikers I see on Highway 26 headed to the coast, by the time they get to my house, they're just kind of cruising. So I have to just encounter respectfully to Representative Bruins. I don't see that bad behavior. I think after they've gone 65 miles, they're probably...
There's no spark left of that.
Yeah. They just want to get to the beach.
Just get over it. Just get this over with.
They prefer walking.
Well, I'm ready for a motion.
I'll just weigh in on this one, too, because I do know that there is bad behavior out there, but most of it is illegal. The problem is we can't even enforce bad behavior from motorists and everybody else, much less bicyclists, so that's one of the big problems. As for the other issue, the Dash 2 amendments, I tend to agree a little bit with Representative Hunt that it does seem contradictory, but if they're happy with the two pieces now and willing to come back, maybe we can look at that. Maybe we can look at the other modes that are moving faster than pedestrians and do it in a more of an inclusive way as opposed to just focusing on one mode. So
I'm not going to ask you.
Mr. Chair, I will move the House Bill, Senate Bill 938A with the dash.
You can move the dash.
Excuse me, the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 938.
Representative Boone moves the dash 2 amendments to 938. Any discussion? Any opposition? Representative Hunt, let me know. Okay. Mike, we're going to need to call the roll.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
I'm excused.
Representative Hunt?
Nope.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate bills 938A as amended to the House floor.
Representative Boone moves 938 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mike?
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Excuse.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. I think we better have a carrier on this one with that number of negatives.
How about threatening voters?
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yes. Okay. I'm sure she'd like to do that.
It was worth a try.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 997. Did we pull that one off?
That's been moved, to Wednesday.
It's all right. Okay, then we don't have any public hearing. We've got one more work session on 3374.
Oh, hello.
Okay.
Sorry.
You were busy.
Yes.
House
Bill 3374, we heard on May 11th. It's the original bill required a person submitting title transfer to pay a fee for previous title transfers. We have, however, received some amendments from the Association of Oregon Counties. We had before us at that meeting the Dash 2 amendments. We now have the Dash 3 amendments, and I believe Art Schlack and Bill Penhollow are here and could speak to those amendments.
Yes. Come on up, Art.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. I want to mention that I've learned more about bicycles in the last hour than I probably knew ever since I was able to ride one, so it's very informative. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you recall, House Bill 3374 with the Dash 2s were before you, as the committee administrator has indicated. At the public hearing, the committee had some discussions about not only looking at, as we had proposed, a 30-day time frame for someone coming to the state of Oregon to get their title their vehicle and do registration. registration, but also to get a driver's license. As a result of the committee's interest in that, we went to legislative council, found that the relating clause to the bill was sufficiently broad enough to add the driver's license provision. So you have before you, Mr. Chair, the dash three amendments that provide for 30 days from the time of qualifying as a resident based on existing statute for somebody to title, to register, and to get a driver's license. Mr. Chair, and so that very simply is the dash threes. We hope that the dash threes will address the issues that were raised by the committee, and we would ask for the committee's support.
Thank you, Art. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I could point out we have received a notice of no fiscal impact for no fiscal or revenue impact for the bill with the dash three amendments.
No revenue or?
No revenue or fiscal impact.
Okay. I probably disagree with that, but that's all right. It's not enough to send it anywhere specific. Thank you, Art.
Thank you.
Robin, do you want to come up and talk to us a little bit about the department's take on this bill?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Robin Freeman, Oregon Department of Transportation. I just wanted to say on the record that we are fine with this legislation. And again, I was going to state on the record we don't anticipate fiscal or revenue impact. That's really all I had to say about this, unless there were any questions.
Questions? Dave? Or excuse me, You're just checking them.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Great. Anyone else testify on 3374? Well, it's a work session. We're in work session anyway. I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments to 3374.
Representative Thatcher moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 3374. Discussion? Opposition? Amendments are passed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3374 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher moves 3374-3 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mike?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative
Bruin? Excused.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Chair Gilman?
Aye. Motion carries. I think we better have somebody explain that.
I think Representative Thatcher wanted to carry it.
That sounds like she does. She's getting
not
good.
Not a consent calendar thing?
Well, I don't know.
I don't care.
So. I mean, I don't care. Let's go ahead and try and put it on there and see. They may tell us we can't do it. But.
We think it's easy.
Yeah, the criteria for putting a bill on the consent calendar for a committee is if there's no votes on committee, the committee can make a motion to do that.
And there wasn't any opposition to this bill.
And there's no opposition, so okay.
There you go.
Representative Thatcher moves we place 3374 on the consent agenda. Any opposition?
I sort of wanted to hear her talk about it. Just me, though.
At least you can remonstrate it. Oh, by the way.
Congratulations, committee. We're doing really well today.
Well, I think if people look in...
Anything else?
Can you talk a little bit about meeting schedule? See the next, this week and next?
Talent, not after, but the other
we've got...
Yes, Mr. Chair, we just put out a revised agenda early this afternoon for Wednesday. It has the aforementioned Senate Bill 997 on it. We had House Bill 3019, which was the rail facility bill on there. The Speaker's office asked us to take that off again.
Are we done with that at this point? Or?
I'm sorry?
Are we done with 3019, or?
No.
It's,
I mean,
being recycled, or?
It's very alive, and I have a constituent that really wants that bill, and I'm hopeful to get it yet, but we keep running up against a little bit of a roadblock.
Also on Wednesday's agenda, we have an informational hearing. Jim Witte and Betsy Imholt and some people from OSU will be coming to talk about the road user fee pilot program, which has now moved to Portland. It was in Eugene, but I've been told it's been moved to Portland. And they'll obviously be coming to talk to us about that. That is at this time what we have scheduled.
Mr. Chair, we're not having a Friday meeting then?
No.
Until we see enough.
And I just don't see it because there's not very much left. I've got a couple of bills that we need to do something with. But we're down there.
How about, would they fit in Hazel? Another road trip? I'm trying to get to Paisley.
Is there any duct tape? I don't know, but I'll go find some.
You just let me know when you want to go to Paisley. We'll go to Paisley, but I don't think the whole committee.
No offense to Paisley. Fine people.
Okay, Patrick, do you have anything else?
That would be all I have for you, Mr.
Okay, Transportation Committee is adjourned.
It's not an inside joke.